Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week I am delighted to present to you Kristen Hawkes, PhD, is a distinguished professor at the University of Utah, where she has taught in the Department of Anthropology for over four decades. She is also a collaborative scientist with the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and has authored over 120 scientific publications. She lectures internationally on our grandmothering life history and menopause as a uniquely human evolutionary advantage. In this interview, Dr. Hawkes discusses the grandmother hypothesis and the environment that likely propelled human evolution. When savanna youngsters couldn't yet manage to feed themselves, grandmothers were there to help forage, supporting dependent grandchildren as their own fertility was ending. In the meantime, still fertile females could invest less in each offspring and have more babies sooner. More robust older females could subsidize more descendants, favoring mutations that enhance postmenopausal longevity. The research of Dr. Hawkes and her colleagues can help us better understand the critical role of intergenerational support and how modern individualism has caused us to veer off track. Just before we get into this week's interview with Dr. Hawkes, I would like to extend thanks to the kind folk who support Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon for helping make this content possible. Supporting us on Patreon comes with perks, including access to our expert-moderated forum. Each week, our scientific director, Megan Hall, takes questions from the forum and answers them in a live office hours session on Zoom. If you're not familiar with Megan, she's been on this podcast many times before. However, for the best introduction to her work, listen to episode 92 of STEM Talk, where Megan is interviewed about her work investigating the potential of a ketogenic diet to extend health span and lifespan. Last week in office hours, Megan talked about potential testing for SARS-CoV-2 and potential COVID-19 therapeutics. If you search for office hours on the forum, you'll find the link to the video replay together with excellent notes, including all the citations. If you currently don't have access to the forum, consider supporting Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon. If, like me, you're out walking the dogs or riding your bike just now, maintaining social distancing, obviously, wearing a mask, obviously, I'll email you later this week with a link to supporters on Patreon. If you're not already receiving the podcast show notes by email from me, open a browser and go to mbt.link. That's mbt.link. And you can sign up there. Thanks again for your support. Now over to the interview with Professor Kristen Hawkes. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I very much appreciate you.
Looks like a beautiful day there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it quite often is at this time of the year in Santa Cruz. I'm very lucky to be recording outdoors right now in the mountains in Santa Cruz. It's fantastic. Perhaps we should start with some disclosures. Are you a grandmother?
No. I mean, this is so tricky. What do we mean by grandmother? So if you mean, so we use it in so many senses. I am definitely a postmenopausal woman. And the way I think about the riddle of our life history and the fact that there are so many people like me running around, so many, you know, apparently healthy, productive postmenopausal women, which is... we are the only primate where it's like that. Our longevity is remarkable, and this postmenopausal stage is really distinctive. It has interested evolutionary biologists really making major contributions. They've noted it, and then they've just gone on to talk about something else because it's easier to kind of simplify it away. But it is a distinctive clue to what happened in our evolution. So in that sense, yes, I am a healthy, productive, postmenopausal human.
Excellent. Well, tell me about how you became interested in grandmothering in the first place. Where were you? Who were you with?
I don't think there was a single eureka moment, although, so there's actually a long history of my, I didn't start out as an evolutionary biologist. I started out really as a kind of garden variety cultural anthropologist. I did my dissertation field work in Highland, New Guinea. I was a little quantitative, but not that quantitative. And I had collected data systematically on who gardens with whom and things like that. And I was here at the University of Utah on the faculty, and I was still analyzing some of the data from my dissertation. There was a guy in the math department. I can tell you this story. It's such a long story if I start at the beginning. there was a guy in the math department I often went to for statistical advice, and he said, and I told him what I was trying to do, and he said, well, we have a visiting professor this term who's interested in these things. You ought to meet him. And I did, and he was amazing, and what is his first name? Watson. There are many Watsons, actually. This is not one of the many. He was a biostatistician. He was a student of R.A. Fisher's, an actual student of Fisher's. And he said to me, he said, there's a guy on the faculty here who works on this stuff that you ought to meet. And he set up a lunch with Eric Charnov in the biology department here, who is a theoretical biologist. And Charnov was amazing because here I was thinking I knew all kinds of stuff, but boy, I mean, I had some biology in my background, but I just did not know very much about evolutionary biology. And Charnov was so patient with me, my failure to know really fundamental things. And he got me into reading the literature and just being astonished at, oh my God, we could actually figure this out. Sexes, aging, wow, this is astonishing. So I had come to be really interested in trying to use some of the tools that people who study other animals are using to try to explain stuff about them. And Charnov had been working on foraging strategies and building some pretty simple models, but aiming to take into account the important pieces of the economics of foraging and using those tools to try to explain the variation in foraging theory, in foraging patterns, in all kinds of animals. And at the same time, this guy joined the faculty here, Jim O'Connell, who is a Paleolithic archaeologist and who also kind of thought there were some things from evolutionary biology, especially theoretical ecology, that might be relevant. He joined the faculty here having just completed a long postdoc in Australia, and he spent a lot of the time in Central Australia with people who used to be full-time foragers, Aaron DeFolks, trying to, because he knew as a actually Western North American archaeologist to begin with, if I could just watch people who are trying to solve these problems of how you actually make a living, I would begin to have some clues about what I'm looking at in the archaeology. So he came to Utah sort of with MacArthur's geographical ecology in his pocket and with the notion that there are these big questions in what happened in human evolution that I had not really thought very much about, and turned me on to those. And then Kim Hill came to Utah having spent time in the Peace Corps in eastern Paraguay, and he had asked for a Peace Corps assignment with an indigenous population, and so he had spent time with these Aché foragers in eastern Paraguay. So Kim Hill showed up in a class of mine. I was talking about these things. He got really excited about it. So we decided we would take some of these models that Charnov was developing and actually go see whether we could measure the right things if we spent time with the Aché in the forest and we actually collected data on the time people spent searching and the profitabilities of the different resources, and we did all that. Could we explain the things that they were choosing to acquire? So we did, and it was amazing. And it turned out that absolutely, it was, these simple models were really useful. But it was also true that this was a very unusual ethnographic situation where these guys, they move around all the time in the forest, which is actually the Brazilian highlands in eastern Paraguay. And so they don't establish a really large domestic space, because you're only going to be there one night most of the time and moving. So everybody is very close together. Even in the southern winter, it actually can get down to zero in the winter, can be really cold. And people not wearing very much, but just kind of around the fire, lying on each other, you know, to stay warm. Wow. So people are so close together that you can actually watch whose stomach all the food goes into. So I know. So we had all these data on the foods that were acquired and then where it ended up getting consumed. And oh, there's another part of the story here where Hilly Kaplan joined our research team in this Aceh project. And Hilly's dissertation was actually looking at that part of the data and, you know, who acquired something and then whose stomach it went into. And because of the close quarters, we had these enormous data sets, and it was possible to see that the things that a man acquired did not go differentially to his own wife, his own mate, and his own kids. And I had come to this project just assuming that the hunting hypothesis is the story of human evolution, because, you know, that's in all the textbooks, and there are all kinds of reasons why everybody thinks that's the story. And here were these data saying this is a case in which that is not what's happening. And then Nick Blurton-Jones, who was at UCLA, invited me and Jim O'Connell to join him. He had just been working in southern Africa with Kung-speaking foragers around Dobie, and he had developed a way of thinking about the way food was acquired that could account for the really long birth spacing that Nancy Howell had described for this population that was consistent with his background, because he was actually a student of Nico Tinbergen's. He had started out as a bird guy, and then he got interested in using a lot of the tools from evolutionary biology to look at this primate. What's going on with this one? So he had been invited by Mel Connor, because they had a mutual interest in kids, to go to Dobie. He'd built this model. Now he wanted, it looked like, wow, this is so useful. He wanted to take it to someplace that was slightly different ecologically. So he started this project in northern Tanzania with the Hadza, and he invited me and Jim O'Connell to join him. So here are the three of us, and we each one of us had slightly different questions in mind. O'Connell, as an archaeologist, one of the issues that was very hot in the early 80s in Paleolithic archaeology was what to make of these archaeological assemblages, and there was a lot of dispute about it, and here was an opportunity in a place where it's modern people, of course, because that's all we got on the planet anymore is us, right, moderns, and modern people who are using these powerful bows and arrows. So they don't go back that far in the archaeological record, but they are bipedal tool users. And in this environment, also, there are all these carnivores that are going after a lot of the same animals. And many of the issues in the archaeology had to do with, ooh, how much of this is the hominins and how much of this is the other carnivores and so on. So O'Connell was focused on what actually happens to these big animals. How do people deal with a big dead animal? And so we paid attention to every single one, every single big animal. And these guys are very effective aggressive scavengers. If a lion or a hyena had killed a big animal, well, you hear about it. You know, they're all the circling vultures, and there's no way you can hide this giant amount of meat. And everybody comes to the carcass, and O'Connell is paying attention to the location of these sites, what kind of site it is, what was happening as the animal was butchered, and then what happened to how it was eaten. And so all kinds of focus on this. But we were, as behavioral ecologists, we were doing systematic observations on everybody interested in both sexes, all ages, how they spent their time, when they were acquiring food, what they got for the time they spent, what it was worth. So we were doing all that. So here I was, you know, spending a lot of time watching these old ladies in the sun. I mean, we were right on the equator. It's high, so it isn't really that bad all the time. But, you know, digging these deeply buried tubers, which is the most energetically expensive way of acquiring plant food. And at one of the first papers we published on this research project was about how effective these old ladies were. The return rates they were getting were the same as the rates that the younger women were getting, but they were spending more time at those particularly energetically expensive ones. Well, grandmothers had not even thought of that as an issue, and I still had in my head, what the heck are these men doing? Because of the riddle that came out of the Aceh work. And at the same time, Charnov, you know, as I said, you shouldn't ask me questions like this because I'm going to tell such a long story. But Charnov was working on life history evolution. So theoretical biologist interested in explaining, he was focused especially on vertebrates and trying to account for how selection could shape this wide variation in life histories. And so it varies in interesting ways between birds and mammals and snakes and lizards. But focusing especially on the mammals, the question was, what can account for the fact that we've got this mouse to elephant curve? You know, here are some mammals that take a long time to grow up, and then they live a long time as adults, and they produce babies at a very slow rate. And at the other end, you know, those little rodents, and they quickly grow up and have lots of babies and die. And he was building models to explain that. And of course, I was spending a lot of time talking to him, still trying to get my mind around what a powerful tool selection thinking can be to try to explain variation. And I was thinking about men and hunting as though that's the crucial thing. And here is Charnov. His models were just about the females. And if you looked across the mammals, it didn't matter what the males were doing. The variables that he had put into his pretty simple optimization accounted for this striking regularity and the allometries in all these features of life history. And, you know, thinking, wow, wasted life. What could be going on? And then we were looking at something and not seeing it until you know to look for it, because our data sets showing the time that women spent at different foraging tasks and what they got for it. So we had this variation across the ages, and we had this variation across little kids. And there was the evidence that the little kids at the things that are the year-round staple are things that little kids are trying when they're little. They're trying to dig these tubers. And there are some kinds of tubers of underground storage organs that they're pretty good at. But those are the ones that are close to the surface. And the deeply buried ones are just not big enough and strong enough to be able to do it. And so they have to depend on their moms. And we were weighing people. I wish we'd weighed them more often than we did, but we were regularly enough that then out of the data came this evidence that the way the kids were growing, the way they were gaining weight, depended on their mother's foraging until she had a new baby. And then there was no link, and the correlation was with grandmother. So right there with these modern people using this suite of resources, we saw that moms could move on and have that next baby because the kid who could still not feed itself was being subsidized by the productivity of grandmothers. You know, these are things that I don't think I've talked about enough, but in the last little while, it's been clear to me that it's just so important to underline the economics of these resources, because it's really different from what goes on with other mammals, with other primates, with other apes, certainly. If we talk about other apes, you know, now we've got this great data from chimpanzees that shows that chimpanzee babies are already, even while they're still nursing and their mom is carrying them along as she's foraging and feeding herself, and they're drinking mother's milk, but they start to acquire the same things she's acquiring before they're even weaned. And then when they're weaned, they feed themselves. And now we've got really good data. Julia Badescu and collaborators at NGOGO have shown this in the isotopes. Melissa Emery-Smith and collaborators at Kanyawara have shown this in the behavior, how the chimpanzee kids, as soon as they're weaned, they're fully competent foragers on their own. Not even close for this primate, right? And the kind of foods that these Hadza guys are depending on in this savanna environment. So the other apes are in the forest, and we know that those forests were retreating with ancient climate change. The savannas were spreading. If you are going to be in those savanna places, then the things that are payoffs year-round for adults are not directly accessible to little kids. And so mom is going to have to subsidize them longer, which would make her birth spacing even longer, but she's not the one that has to do it. And the way you actually are an efficient forager on these things is not the kind of one at a time feeding that characterizes what the other apes do. You do it in these piles. And so there is this pile of tubers, and if we add cooking, which is another issue, there's all this processing. And here is a thing that is an opportunity for all those little appropriators to be in there taking shares. And so if that's the kind of foraging you're doing, it's going to be the case that the women who are still fertile can have a next baby sooner without losing the older one, because her whole trade-off surface has changed. Now it's the case that those little kids are taking advantage of the foraging of the older females. And so out of all this came recognizing that, wait a minute, if we go back to Charnov's model, one of the regularities that he saw across the mammals was this relationship between age at first birth and adult mortality, or average adult lifespan. And he'd actually published a figure just for primates to show that this holds across the primates. And it included this primate. I mean, the book was published in 93, and that was a time when, you know, we separated the apes, the pongids, and the hominids as two separate taxon. Now we know that actually we belong to the same family. We're all hominids. Chimpanzees are actually closer to us than to gorillas. But anyway, they were separated there. And yet the human point fit on the regression. And it should have been, how is that possible? I should have recognized that in 93. Didn't. Coming back to it, oh, look at that. The way in which that would make sense, given Charnov's model, is if that post-fertile period was actually subsidizing the fertility at the younger ages. And if that were true, then there was another feature of his model that within the model should stand out like a sore thumb. And that is that it should mean that the birth intervals are way shorter than would be expected for a mammal with our age at first birth. And voila, there it was. And the first papers, sort of right back to back, the one where we really focused on that theory, were going back, looking more closely at what the best data were at the time for the other apes, what the best data are for this ape, but in foraging circumstances, so among hunter-gatherers. And we showed how well the human case fit the model if we included the contribution to future generations, to future gene pools that came from the subsidies of the older females. So this is dangerous, Christopher, because I can go on and then...
It's fantastic. You're interviewing yourself. Like, this is, I don't even need to be here. This is brilliant.
That's a terrible way to do it. It's so boring. But, you know, I'm telling it as kind of a history. And that then we were so lucky to have this mathematical biologist, Peter Kim, get interested in the problem, because you could say, oh, yeah, well, it fits the model. But come on, how do we know that happened? And you know, of course, how do we? But you can build models. And the thing about Charnov's model is it was just about the females. So Peter took this grandmother hypothesis, assumed the regularities, the specific allometries that are in Charnov's model, and made it a two-sex model. So it had both males and females, and then built an agent-based model to see whether if you started out with a great ape-like life history, especially paying attention to chimpanzees because we have the best data for them, if you start out with that and then you allow those very few females that are outliving their fertility, because boy, is that rare among chimpanzees, but you now allow them to subsidize the still dependent juveniles. And oh, there you can see in the figures in the papers where all it takes is that. And then what happens in these agent-based models is life history goes from something that looks very chimpanzee-like to something that looks very much like what you see in humans in those foraging circumstances, with about a third of the adult females past the fertile ages. So very exciting stuff. And see, now I can, it just goes on and on. When we were talking earlier, I said, I just keep being surprised. There's another thing. And, you know, so we can talk about implications for, because now we got two sexes, but everybody's living longer. The thing is, fertility's ending in the females, not in the males, because, you know, you continue to make sperm all the time. It's just, mammals generally, you know, spermatogenesis continues throughout adulthood. In female mammals, generally, there's also some similarity with birds, but, you know, females start out with all the oocytes they're ever going to have. And in us, that's when you're still a 5-month-old fetus, and then you just start losing them. So reproductive physiology is really different in the two sexes. But so now, with a life history like ours, you've got these fertile ages for females, and now all these old guys who are still fertile. Well, the only way that they are going to get genes into future generations is by mating with the still fertile females. So we get a bunch of stuff about mate guarding. And a thing that I will definitely want to talk about is the brain's side of the story and the social cognition side of the story for, you know, us as a primate, but why it is the challenges to infants coming in to a life history like ours that set up the sorts of things that really ring our bell cognitively and shape us to be doing this. You know, here I am. I want you to, do you see what I'm trying to paint here as a story? This is a thing that we, it is for us, it's what we always want to do all the time. And there is a story here about how that is a thing that came with the peculiar life history that marks us out. So let me pause, stop ranting, which of course, you know, there we have the danger. I am likely to do that, and take a breath and say, did that make sense?
It absolutely made sense. So what you're saying is that humans are perhaps unique in their ability to reproduce more rapidly. The space between babies is much shorter. And the reason we can do that is because we have other people, especially grandmothers, that can invest in that initial generation while mom goes on to have more babies. My question is it uniquely human? Why is it that, you know, I've sometimes heard people refer to humans as the third chimpanzee, right? You've got chimpanzees, bonobos, and then humans. If this strategy is optimal and comes with this increased life expectancy, why is it that just humans do this and not chimpanzees and bonobos.
Because, so going back to the thing that set this off, if you are a chimpanzee or a bonobo, then what's happening is, as mom is eating the soft fruits and so on, and the THV if you're a bonobo, and all the leaves and so on in the forest, mom is carrying you along, and you've got her attention. You don't have to do anything to get it, and she's holding you, and she is feeding herself, and you begin to do that as an infant before you're weaned, and then you can do it independently when increasingly less and less of what you require comes from mother's milk, and now it's all you're feeding yourself, and now she has another one, and you still may, your relationship, social relationship with her may be important, but now you are feeding yourself. Well, a very different setup comes from colonizing those savanna habitats and taking advantage of resources that are not this hand-to-mouth thing, that are not things that little nursing infants can possibly begin to feed themselves directly on. It is the case that as you are foraging for these things that give you a high rate as an adult, it requires the strength of an adult to do this. And if you're going to exploit those, you don't do it one at a time. You know, you don't do, oh, that's part of a tuber, let me stop and eat that. No, because now you've opened the hole, getting the rest of that one and the one next to it and so on. And in fact, having somebody doing that near you means you're mutualistically getting higher returns. And then if you cook them together, what you have is a whole different foraging economics, and the opportunities then for both adults and children, but especially for those little kids, means that mom doesn't have to be the one that's continuing to feed that kid, but the whole thing about slower maturation that goes with the increased longevity that all of this is favoring because of the productivity of the older females, which is making all of this possible. Right. So all those pieces go together that mean if those are the kinds of resources you're exploiting, a bunch of things follow in the ways in which there is interdependent resource acquisition, which we do not see in any other primate. It is not, I mean, chimpanzees hunt. This is, it's kind of a, maybe a red herring, but always has been of interest. I paid a lot of attention to what we know about chimpanzee hunting when I still thought, oh, the human evolution is all about hunting. What's the difference between what chimpanzees do and what humans do? One of the things about chimpanzee hunting is the ones who end up eating most of the monkeys that they hunt are the males. It's a whole different kind of story that seems really more to do with politics among the males. But the patterns of food acquisition, you know, the fundamental issue of getting the nutrients you need to carry on and do what you do is so different if it's these savanna resources that you're exploiting.
I see.
So if you're a gorilla kid, you know, you are, mom is eating these leaves and you're starting to eat them too while you're still a nursing infant, and then you're independent as soon as you're weaned. So think about your two-year-old, right? Think about your two-year-old. What if he had to get his own lunch? That would, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not happening. And the allometries are also part of this story, by which I mean these life history feature scales. So it is the case that there are primates that have shorter adult lifespans, mature earlier, have shorter intervals. And so it's not that we have the shortest, it's that they're so short for an ape. And again, because we have this later age at maturity, so there are all kinds of reasons why later maturity goes with slower maturation, goes with increased longevity. Those pieces were in Charnov's model already. So these two things are happening in our evolution, that the duration of development is slower and weaning is earlier. And if we start to throw brains into the story, which I completely ignored for a long time. I thought, we've got all these other tools that are so useful, and everybody thinks it's all about this big brain we have, and that's the story of our evolution. And now I happened to run across Barbara Finlay, who's a cognitive neuroscientist, have taken on board what she and her lab have been doing for more than the last two decades about what actually runs the variation in brains across the mammals, and its duration of development. And that depends on longevity. Its duration of development that accounts for why our neocortex is so big, because what and Finlay and her group have explained all this. So this big brain goes with this life history, and the thing that's really sets up all these interesting features of the cognitive ecology that human infants confront come from the fact that brains are, they're going to get bigger, they are developing more slowly, and weaning is earlier. Wow. So right. You've got those things. If you take on board the allometries and you look at our weaning age compared to what would be expected, we are just really outliers. That should have been the focus of attention. And now that I see these two things, this extremely early weaning compared to these aspects of maturation and the postmenopausal survival, that these are linked in a way that sets up the cognitive ecology for human infants, that then makes whatever, because your mom likely has another kid now, she's stacking up these dependents, and yet you're completely dependent on attention, support, tolerance, all kinds of things from other conspecifics. You want them to like you. You want them to support you. You want to, and a whole array of things that then explain why we are so socially precocious. Human infants, even though they're just babies, you know, remember when your two-year-old was, I mean, now a toddler, and it sounds like, you know, rattling off stories and so on by two, but remember when that baby was just a baby and yet kind of unable to do anything motorically and yet so prepared to be engaged, smile at you, and you just melt, and oh, you just want to get a giggle out of that kid, and a whole array right. of things going on there that are, and this is where Sarah Hurdy's insights about the cognitive ecology of babies in our species, given that they don't have the full engagement of their mother, as a chimpanzee mother is fully engaged with this kid because she's only got this one at a time, and it's only when it's independent that she'll have the next. That's not what we do. And that sets up these challenges for human infants with a whole array of consequences that I think developmental psychologists have been paying attention to, most of them not focused so much on the evolution story, just trying to, you know, imagine this. Here is a baby coming into the world. How does it figure it out? And so there's a long history in developmental psychology of trying to both describe and explain that. And now I see the links between what they've been talking about and this peculiar life history that begins with the move into these savanna resources and the productivity of older females and so on.
If you would allow me to raise a Please. Common objection, is it not true that living past childbearing years is the direct result of modern medicine?
Oh, I'm so glad you raised it. And my longtime collaborator, Nick Blurton-Jones, if he were here, he would be cheering that, because he's the guy who's done all the heavy lifting demographically in our HADSA project. And because lots of skepticism about the kind of longevity that you see in living populations, how far that goes back in time, is in the literature. And when Nancy Howell, who was the demographer for the Kalahari, for the Harvard Kalahari Project, when she reported that, oh, look, there are all of these, this substantial fraction of the population that is over 60, there was a lot of skepticism about that. And she took a lot of heat from people who should have known better. And there was a lot of argument that, oh, she used these models because she was trained as a sociological demographer and used these models to try to figure out how to do demography on a population where you can't say to people, what's your birth date? You know, let me see your driver's license. You know, if you're working with, imagine trying to do this with non-human animals where the chances of figuring out how old everybody is are so difficult. I mean, it's no wonder that it took so long to begin to have data on that. But there are a lot of human populations in which figuring out how old everybody is really tricky. And to estimate what's the likelihood of dying at a particular age, you'd know what the survival curve looks like. Boy, is it difficult to do that. And the idea that, now we've got all these old people floating around and we're worried about them. We're worried about us now because right in the current scare about the coronavirus. But the notion that there weren't any old people in the past comes partly, and I actually hear this from people who are really smart and they know about stuff that I don't know. Yeah. And I want to know what they know. But one of the things that's really misleading is to use the parameter life expectancy, because life expectancy is an average. And so if you use that to characterize a population, life expectancy at birth, and if there's high fertility and there are a lot of dying babies, dying children, then you have a lot of really short lifespans that go into that average. So, for example, in the three best demographic studies of foraging populations, one is the Aceh, and that's Kim Hill and Magdalena Hurtado. One is the Kung, that's Nancy Howell's work. And then the third is the Hadza. This would be Nick's work on the Hadza. Life expectancy is less than 40 in every case. But that's because of all the dying babies and children. If you actually make it to adulthood and you're female, your chances of living past your fertility are way better than not. I don't have those numbers in front of me. It's like 70% or more if you make it to adulthood, right? And so what has misled us is looking at, if there was a wonderful paper at the beginning of the 2000s, Open and Vopel. I find myself disagreeing with Jim Vopel about a lot of things, but this paper was so important. And what they did was they pulled together life table data, demographic data from all over the world, and pulled out the nations. So now we're talking about societies that have nation states and where there are census data, and they pulled out the winning nation for each year beginning in, I think they started in 1850, and then showed what happened each year picking the winning nation. And they showed this march in increase in life expectancy that was just extremely regular all the way up to, you know, wherever they ended, which was not very long before they wrote the paper. See this increase. And the thing that is fueling that is the decline in fertility and infant and child mortality. So if you take Sweden, which was the winning case in 1850, this is an example I've often used in talks, so I should remember the data better. I think life expectancy in Sweden was 45. In Open and Vopel's data set, you don't get life expectancy past 50 until the beginning of the 20th century. So there's a good census for Sweden, so you can look at that at the life table, and there you see the same things that you see in these foraging cases. A third of the females are past the end of their fertility. And the thing that is making that average low is not that there aren't any old people. It's that there are a lot of short lives that go into the average.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I wonder why anyone uses that term, life expectancy. It's so incredibly misleading. Don't you think?
Well,
How much damage has been done to people's understanding of humanity by that term?
I mean, I can think of so many examples of things where using an average is so misleading. And yet, if you can only know one thing, sometimes, you know, statisticians will say, if you can only know one thing, the expectation is especially valuable. So there you go. I mean, I could then talk about these issues around hunting. If you take the average that is contributed to the diet from these occasional bonanzas, then you think, oh, it's all about meat. And that continues to be the thing that's in the literature. It's the same kind of error. You know, those bonanzas are a big deal. Everybody pays attention. Woohoo, this party. But when it comes to eating every day, when it comes to the kind of thing that's required for selection to actually favor the kinds of shifts that we're talking about, it's got to be this reliable daily thing. And those bonanzas are anything but. But if you look at the average,
Talk about estrogen. Is it something else I've heard for menopause is that maybe nature's done with you, you know, and that hormone replacement therapy is a good idea because your estrogen is going to go away and you probably don't want what nature wants for you. And so perhaps you should think about replacing those hormones. But I'm not sure that's necessarily true. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the data that have followed from concerns about the heavy emphasis on hormone replacement showing how dangerous it can be, and a lot of studies that then got stopped as a consequence of recognizing that. Yes. So let's take it as in the form of a riddle, because it is. I mean, you need estrogen for all kinds of things, for all kinds of things that go on. You need it as well as I need it. My brain needs it. So many of my tissues need it. There's so many parts of my physiology that require it. And yet, here I am, postmenopausal, I am getting no estrogen from my ovaries. What the heck? Where is that coming from? Well, the thing about these steroid hormones is with the right accessory proteins, the peripheral tissues convert other steroids into the estrogen they need. So you get the estrogen in your peripheral tissues from the conversion of testosterone. I get the estrogen in my peripheral tissues from the conversion of adrenal androgens, probably DHEA, DHEAS. There was a Canadian endocrinologist. I have not ever met this guy. I think he's retired and maybe he's not around anymore. And has said in print some strange things about evolution. But he was very interested in trying to understand, as an endocrinologist, what is going on with all these hormones. And one of the things that he concluded, and humans were his animal of interest, one of the things that he concluded was that even during the cycling years, women get 75% of their estrogen from the conversion of DHEA, DHEAS. So the notion that it requires ovarian estrogen to run all these things, well, once again, you know, your brain needs estrogen. You don't have any ovaries, probably. So we've got the recognition that these steroids play important roles, but boy, this amazing physiology that nature has given us does really incredible things in conversion of one steroid into another. And in a lot of ways, the connection between hormones and fertility, you know, there was all kinds of weird stuff about how you'll slow aging if you're injected with monkey gonads. And I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff that went on when people made the connection between hormones and other things. And a lot of it, when you look back on it, it's like, you know, bleeding people when they had various kinds of pathological conditions. And good heavens, it's amazing that people lived through it. So the physicians who have a practice with women who are experiencing uncomfortable symptoms associated with perimenopause and really want to know what to do about that, you know, I don't have patients like that. It does seem to be the case from the literature I read that we have this very interesting feature. And you may actually know more about this than I do, Christopher, because it may be something you followed more closely. But there is this interesting thing about testosterone, which once again, men are, you know, making testosterone throughout adulthood, starting well before that. But if you look at circulating levels of testosterone in different populations, it is Western men, and you know, there are probably more data now. I know this from a while ago when it was a Boston sample compared to a few other cases. One of them was the Aceh. So among these, remember we started out with the Aceh, these guys in Eastern Paraguay, and those guys are, they are extremely buff and they do this very energetically expensive thing running through the closed forest when they're hunting. And if you compare circulating T in Aceh men with age, this is Richard Brabiscus's thesis, and you compare that to the levels with Boston men, what you see is that this young age high T is missing among the Aceh. And I think the data sets are more complicated, but I think we have a similar thing with women, that levels of estrogen can be high in populations like ours that are under-exercised and overfed and under-diseased and all those things. So we can afford to have these high levels compared to populations that are experiencing an ecology that's a lot more like most of our history, in which there's more exercise, less food, more disease, and so right. on. So the segue back to the question of perimenopausal symptoms is that it could well be that if associated with other metabolic characteristics of our population, that that makes perimenopause, associates it with discomfort in ways that are not typical. And there are anthropologists, I think of Lynette Sievert, who has looked at menopausal symptoms in lots of different populations using various kinds of devices, like putting monitors on women that are measuring their body temperature and also giving them something to record when they think they're having a hot flash, and finding disconnect between what's happening physiologically and what women are reporting. Her work is, you know, continues to be interesting. All those things are the variation among populations, depending on probably not only the current experience, but also so much about earlier parts of life and development that continue to affect us through adulthood.
Yeah, that's relevant here. I think what's interesting to think about for men is how the social structure has changed and the facultative role of parenting in men, right? It's like if there's no grandmother, there's no alloparents to take up the slack, then perhaps the man will step in. And I've learned from Sarah Hurdy that there may be some physiological changes, including an increase in prolactin, decrease in testosterone. And that is indeed what you see on the beach in Hawaii, is the man sort of bottle feeding a baby, dripping in prolactin with moobs, you know, like that's kind of what I just saw when I was on holiday recently. And it did make me think about the facultative role of the father figure.
And you think about these ethnographic cases in which the way things are arranged, this is in some traditional societies, is to keep young men away from children and babies. And don't let any of that happen, because we need them to go off and be fierce and, you know, compete with each other. And yeah, I think, I mean, I've heard Sarah Hurdy talk about imagining that you have a bunch of, I don't know, military guys all sitting around and throw some babies on the table and see if you can change the mood. Yeah.
So you're not seeing that. You might think then that some of these symptoms surrounding perimenopause might be mismatched diseases, as perhaps Daniel Lieberman would say, right? So you're not seeing hot flashes in the Aceh or the Kung or the Hadza.
Well, I would have to say that it isn't something I ever looked for or looked at, and I've learned so often that I can be staring right at something, taking notes about it, and not see what I'm looking at. But no, I was completely unaware of that being an issue. And the burden of evidence looks so much like there is actually an historian who's written a book about the history of menopause. And I think, although I think she isn't bought into the grandmother hypothesis, but I think she is onto something, that it surfaces as an issue in our contemporary socioecology in ways that wouldn't even come up in, for example, you know, in one of the questions that Hadza women would ask is, why does she have more kids than I do? So there would be questions like that. You know, some women are more successful at keeping babies alive. Let's say grandmother's really doing her job in those cases, and those things do vary. And Nick has shown that having a grandmother has this huge effect on the chances that a kid will survive in the Hadza case. So I think recognizing this feature of our lifetimes, that we even have such a thing, is almost a construct of our culture, that we make it a big deal because of our focus on youth and health. And I, one of the things that makes me worry sometimes, young women, so let's say college students who don't know about our life history and don't know about this evolutionary story, and it I think it's so easy for them not to take on board that this is a feature of being human, and especially, you know, what's happening with our socioecology, where you don't want to have a kid yet until you're established, and you think, I want to make sure that I have a good job, and that because I want to be able to, and therefore the age at first birth keeps getting later and later. And women think, well, as long as I'm healthy, then I'll just keep putting it off until, without realizing that menopause is part of our evolution.
Right.
And so although every once in a while it does kind of get into the magazines, you know, the biological clock issue, I think it is that women do not realize that you can be very healthy, and yet the readiness with which you conceive begins to decline, at least according to the IVF data sets, and maybe there are some problems with those, but it actually begins to decline in your late 20s. And one of the things that, right. So with Ken Smith, who's a demographer and who runs the Utah population database, he and I looking at, so the Utah population database is this incredible resource because it records all these births and deaths for the colonists who came to Utah. It actually starts in the 18th century. And so you have these long family histories. And we were using that data set for something. And one of the things that it was so striking as we were looking at these was seeing in Nick's data that there are a large fraction of Hadza women who will not have another birth after 35. And it was essentially the same in this very pronatalist population we were looking at in these Utah colonists, that it's about the same fraction. And so once again, there's all kinds of individual variation. It's like, what is the age of menopause? And boy, is that hard to measure. And the WHO says, you measure it when 1 year has passed since your last period. Well, what woman knows that? But the data that are available show there's a lot of variation. You know, it can range from 40 to 60, actually. And people who've studied menopause find that the age at last birth and the age at menopause aren't, you know, they can be 10 years apart at least. Mm. So wherever we started with whatever's going on with both parenting and family structure in our current socioecology, the extent to which knowing something about our evolved life history allows people to make better choices. I don't know whether it does that follow or not. I remember having a conversation with a student last term we were talking about some feature of our biology, and she was saying, that's not fair. And I was saying, yeah, I've always thought it isn't fair that I can't fly, you know, damn. Although, you know, there was a time when you could get on a plane, I guess.
That's true. So talk about the implications for cognition. You hinted at that earlier, right? So if the woman's role is changing and you're better off investing in your grandchildren than you are having your own kids, what does that mean for your cognition?
Well, the hook to cognition that for me is the one to emphasize is the one that Sarah Hurdy saw. And I, as I said, it amazes me that I didn't see this, and I didn't see it until she, because she actually sees it's in things she wrote way earlier than the 2009 book. It's just that in the 2009 book, which people keep citing as 2011, maybe it was reissued then. But anyway, this is Mothers and Others. And this is where she makes the connection to what Michael Tomasello has been talking about with this shared intentionality thing, that we just have this appetite to try to be on the same page with others and find ways to do that. And we have those concerns. She links that to this, the challenges to infants, given the moms moving on, having the next kid before this one is independent, mom having... She talks about ambivalent mothering, and she's pulled together, you know, really relevant data on this question. It is, you know, following her on this, it is in our order of primates, for the most part, the danger of infanticide to infants comes from males. And you know, this is another place where her work was so groundbreaking on understanding male infanticide and then counter strategies to that. But we are an unusual primate in that it is the case that it's moms who sometimes kill their own kid. And this, her label for this ambivalent mothering connects it to this feature of our life history, so that this baby that I'm just about to have, I've got these other kids who are still dependent. And so this issue of how I decide to allocate my limited resources among these things is going to make me very sensitive to discriminative solicitudes, making choices about where to put my attention and effort. And that, as she argues, sets up these amazing challenges for infants. So here is this newborn, and it does not have as a birthright full maternal engagement, which, if you're another kind of primate, when you have that baby, you don't have any other dependents. And so that's where your attention is. Well, that's not true for us. And that sets up these challenges. This is her way of framing this, sets up these challenges for infants that then means tendencies and capacities to be effective at soliciting engagement come to be so important for likely survival through infancy. And then, you know, linking back to the arguments that I've been making about this interdependent foraging, those things continued in ancestral populations because you are still dependent on others even after you're weaned. And therefore, this appetite for social engagement, for shared attention, for this thing that Tomasello calls shared intentionality is enormous. And Tomasello's experiments, this was Esther Herman was the first author on this paper, but it's the one that's so frequently cited, where they did experiments with orangutans, chimpanzees, and then little kids. And the little kids were, I think, on average about 2.5, you know, just like your son and the twins. And they were all given similar problems to solve. And when it came to the physical problems, you know, I forget what they were, object permanence and things like that. I should remember, but it was pretty similar. They all kind of did, they were equally good. But when it came to a social cue identifying, contributing to the problem and the solution, well, then the kids were really different. And right. So what's underlined there is that now takes me back to what developmental psychologists have been saying for decades, that there are these sort of core domains of knowledge. There's baby physics, which is about stuff like gravity and object permanence. Baby biology, which is about how animals and plants are living things, and that's different. And then this third thing, baby psychology, which is about what's the intention of that individual. And that third thing, the first two are baby anythings have to do that. They have to figure out gravity and object permanence and, you know. But this other thing where the preferences, the intentions of other people of your conspecifics are absolutely crucial to your survival. So that whole domain of getting your brain wired to attend to that, to make predictions about that, to adjust around that. Your brain is wired to prioritize that. And back to the things I was saying about brains before, that this brain is developing really slowly to be bigger. And so this wiring is going on so early, getting wired to that as just taking priority over so many things. And that kind of prioritizing reputations is that, oh, do you know those experiments from the Yale Baby Lab about when these are just tiny infants, I forget how old they are, less than a year, way less than a year, but where they show them shapes, they show them cartoons of shape trying to go up the hill, and then the bad shape pushing it down, and then the good shape helping it. And
this is so familiar.
Yeah, I'm sure you've come across that. And what they find is this really big effect that the babies prefer the helpful ones, you know. So paying attention to reputation already, and there are all kinds of reasons why that would be so important for survival. So tendencies to do that get wired really early, and then they continue because, again, in ancestral circumstances, you're still dependent. You are all these other individuals where the foraging is so interdependent. That's different from what we see with other primates and with other apes. And so the whole cognitive thing that fluoresces in us, it was Herdy's insight to link that to this feature of our life history. And then that continues through life. So, you know, so grandmothers were babies once. I mean, this is another line from Gopnik, the developmental psychologist's work, talking about, I told you, The Scientist in the Crib is the title of one of the books. And she and another collaborator say, we're not saying that scientists are babies. I'm gonna screw up the quote, so maybe I won't give it. But that scientists are grown up babies, and I would say we are all grown up babies, right? So this is stuff that got wired into us early on, and it continues through life. And so we care about reputations and a whole array of other things.
I thought you were going to tell me about implications for grandma. You know, if the whole reason why you're still here, age 60 and above, where all the, you know, old chimpanzee women are gone, is to invest in your grandchildren. What does that mean for your cognition? Like, is there something you should be thinking about if you don't have access to grandchildren?
Well, you know, the famous bumper sticker, which maybe has proliferated now, you know, the retired couple with the bumper sticker, we're spending our grandchildren's inheritance, or right? you mean, does having this life history suggest that for the good of future gene pools, we should be doing X? You know, I'm too much of an evolutionary biologist to be very comfortable with anything that has this good of the group, good of the species, good of the population flavor. I think the shared intentionality thing is just as big a deal through all the ages. And I think that the neuroscientists would talk about how the plasticity of brains, so I underline this being wired early for these particular things in us, but there is a lot of plasticity that continues through life that is adjusting to current circumstances. And this reminds me of but what we've been experiencing matters. And this reminds me of a story that a colleague at a conference who she's Japanese, lives in Japan, and for reasons that I don't quite recall, we were talking about, and I think her mother is in an old folks' home, and we were talking about the use of robots. And, you know, there's a name for these little things that squeak that are seem so cute. Well, there's the Baby Yoda story, of course, where everybody's just so excited about Baby Yoda. Isn't he cute? But she was telling me that her mother had one of those robot-like things that was regularly doing something, delivering to her, maybe squeaking at her, I don't know. And then the place where she was, they got a new generation of robots that were much more human-like. You know, they had things that were more like faces. And so her mother experienced the new robot, and she was so sad because she was so used to the other robot and she wanted it back. She had become so attached to that robot. And this thing that is, you know, is part of this, that we relationships matter so much to us. We're so invested in them. And in fact, one of my first, I told you that when I was first reading Sarah Hurdy's Mothers and Others, it was right before it came out, and I had a pre-publication copy. I was reading it on an airplane, and the first thing I thought about was, that helps explain the grief that we feel when we lose a partner. You know, that this thing that we, with a long time close friend or spouse or somebody that we have shared a lot of things with, when we lose them, we've lost so much of who we are. And the sense of grief that goes with that is part of this shared intentionality thing. And the grandparent connection to grandchildren, just like the parent connection to children. And just, of course, so I have lots of ideas about what in ancestral populations, what hunting was about, what is going on with the evolution of our pairing habits, and what is going on with male-male competition, which I think is such a huge thing. I don't think any of it is at all contradictory with these really strong relationships that men can have with either their own kids or somebody else's kids. That it's part of this social cognition that we all have, and that we can become so attached to particular individuals that we, you know, then have done things with, engaged with, know, and it becomes a part of our stories about ourselves.
Can you talk about, you know, have you any thoughts about the implications for how we organize society today? So you've spent however many years investigating the importance of grandmothering. And then when I look around me today, I see those people quite often isolated from the very people that they should be investing in. And I wonder what that means for us as society today. And if you have any thoughts
I register the same things. I mean, one of the things that people who live in more communitarian context, and then they visit the United States and it seems so cold and cruel, and you know, the whole nursing home thing that seems so, really, have we come to that? There is a thing that is associated with the shared intentionality thing. So I wonder if I can say something coherent here. I'm not sure that I can, but that because we are so attached, we don't want to lose the people that we're close to. And of course, that fuels our enormous medical establishments to try to slow aging, to try to save people who would otherwise die, to do everything we can to keep them with us. And again, I'm enough of an evolutionary biologist to think that aging is, that natural selection, a result of natural selection, is senescence. That is, again, part of our evolutionary, a legacy of a history of natural selection. But the attempts to try to keep people alive as long as possible, it's so easy to understand. And to some extent, it's successful. I mean, one of the things that I've spent a little time on is looking across sort of what goes on with the demographic profile of different populations. And one of the things that characterizes all populations, not just human ones, but there's all this heterogeneity. You know, individuals are all different in all kinds of ways. And in contexts where there is high mortality early on, the more vulnerable are more likely to die earlier. And as you keep moving through the ages, you get a more and more select subset of individuals who have had a lower probability of dying all along, and they're the ones who are left. And there is a famous feature of survival curves that's called the Streller-Mildven correlation that shows that the higher the what's called the initial mortality, which is supposed to be an estimate of just how dangerous things are, the way that relates to then the rate of increase through adulthood in mortality, that the higher the overall mortality is, the shallower the slope. In other words, it makes it look like higher overall mortality means slower aging. Well, that sounds crazy, doesn't it? How can that be? But one interpretation of that is the one I just already suggested, that if the mortality is very high, then you have this increasingly select subset in populations like ours where very low fertility, and even though we worry about the high infant mortality that we have, it is astonishingly low, actually, in our population.
Right.
And because we try to do everything we can to not let people die, it means that as we move through those ages, the heterogeneity is still there. And that means it's not just the most robust that are still left. It's all of us. You know, those of us that would have died of something else, we're still there. And that helps explain why it looks like then the mean increases faster. So all of this is connected back to this idea that we don't want the people we're close to die. We spend all kinds of things trying to prevent that. You know, people right now movingly about the terrible deaths that people end up having in hospitals with all kinds of money spent and strapped up to all kinds of stuff, which seems so awful. And other ways in which we do not handle death well in this society, and we're always trying to prevent it. And so we have this contradiction that we don't want people to die, and so they end up often dying in ways that are undesirable, that they would not desire. This is maybe old data, maybe outdated, but I remember a few years ago reading that the people who are the ones who work in medical facilities where they have to do this, who are asked to check boxes about do not resuscitate, they all say, do not resuscitate. Because
I've heard about that data. They just want morphine, nothing else.
Yeah, because they know that really the odds are it will just be this huge, enormous expense and a not a pleasant death.
I've just finished reading Natural Causes by Barbara Ehrenreich, which is a fantastic book. And she writes about this, that you're not extending life, you're extending death.
Absolutely. Right. Well, I haven't read it, but she's amazing. So I should put it on my list to read.
She's a woman scorned, but she's very, very good.
Oh, scorned for that.
Well, no, just in general. She just seems quite cynical, you might say. But she writes so well. I really enjoy her.
Right. Well, isn't she nickel and dimed? Or is that somebody else?
That's exactly right. Rethinking, I forget the name. Oh, Brightsided. Brightsided is the other one.
Oh, I haven't read that one. Yeah. So I'm...
Yeah, yeah. It's a book about positive psychology. Very good.
Have to catch up.
So tell me about your future directions. What are the things that you would like to know?
The thing that I'm trying to figure out how to make distance on now because of this, well, a combination of things, the learning the stuff about brains from Finlay and her colleagues and what they've been doing. I don't think I did lay this out that what they've shown is that across the mammals, and this is, well, it's a little different in marsupials, but across the eutherian mammals, the thing that predicts brain size is the duration of development, which is predicted by longevity. And it's not only the final brain size, but the size of several of the key components, like the neocortex that we think is such a big deal. And there's an allometry. So I've mentioned allometries before. I think one of the reasons it was so easy for me to hear what she was talking about was because I'd worked on that, trying to understand Charnov's models. But the neocortex increases allometrically with size. So as brains get bigger with longer duration of development, the relative size of the neocortex gets bigger. So all of this is going on, says me, as a consequence of our grandmothering life history. That's why we have that. And so the early wiring of this brain for this extreme sociality sets us up for where the social context is so important. And one of the things that sometimes their evolutionary psychologists have been working on is across contemporary populations in the state societies like ours. I don't quite know what to use as a label for this, but you know the acronym weird societies, right? So that comes from white, industrial, educated, democratic, and right, that's so many of the experiments and the reports of features that are essentially human come from subjects that are part of weird societies. But it's not just that, it's the middle classes, right? So actually within societies like ours, the range of variation is, this is another example where averages can be misleading, people who haven't found their place in our society, and unfortunately increasing numbers of people who find themselves like that, what it is then that babies growing up in those circumstances, how exactly they deal with those things. And I have an incoming student who brings special insights about this, and I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes. And there's another story to tell about this. I mentioned the Yale Baby Lab and those things with animations showing the good shapes and the bad shapes and babies with a really strong effect. Well, so can I say parentheses? There is an argument that's gotten attention in the last little while about our evolution that features the claim that we're cooperative because of self-domestication. Have you come across this? Mm-hmm. So Richard Wrangham recently has a book about this, and he and Brian Hare, some of the initial papers Brian Hare was involved in, and
I was going to mention him earlier when you were talking about survival of the friendliness and dog.
Oh, there you go. That's right. Dogs. That's right. So so he's really interested in dogs and so on. But he also has been interested in aspects of human evolution, and he and Wrangham together were working on this self-domestication argument, which I do not buy. It's very inconsistent with most things I know, and so I would have more to say about that. But, well, maybe I have to say more about it right now. It doesn't, the thing that I think Sarah Hurdy was right about, that it's this life history feature that underlies why our social cognition seems to have characteristics that we don't see in the other apes. And when this self-domestication idea, it didn't start with Hare and Wrangham, but they got intrigued by trying to understand the bonobo chimpanzee difference, which is a fascinating one. You know, so these are our closest living relatives, right? And yet they seem to be so different from each other. And the argument that they elaborated was that bonobos were nicer and more cooperative and with all these other interesting social aptitudes because of self-domestication. And that what had happened in bonobos was that females were just not having aggressive males. They were out, and the consequence was self-domestication, and that hadn't happened in chimpanzees. But the way they made the argument originally, it was that the self-domestication is associated with social neoteny and being childlike longer. And so they did these experiments with chimpanzees and bonobos showing that bonobos seem to be delayed in various kinds of things and seemed to be childlike longer. And so that was supposed to be consistent with the argument. But then the argument is that we are self-domesticated. And so my challenge to that was, wait a minute, bonobos are self-domesticated, and an index of that is that they are so neotenous socially compared to chimpanzees, and we are self-domesticated, and yet we are socially so precocious compared to either one of them. So wait a minute, is it that self-domestication slows social development or speeds it up? Which is it? Those are inconsistent, was my argument. Well, here is the background, some of the background to my attention to what they are finding. And within the last couple of years, Brian Hare, with a collaborator whose name I'm sure I should mention, but not only has he been doing interesting stuff with dogs, but he also has been doing interesting stuff with bonobos. So in one of these refugee places in Africa, they actually managed to do a version of the Yale Baby Lab experiment with bonobos. Now, that could happen is astonishing. But of course, and the paper just simply ignores all this, so the expectation should have been that here are the bonobos with a choice between the whatever it is, you know, the bad square and the good triangle or whatever, that the bonobos would, because they're bonobos and they're so cooperative, they would favor the good. It's just the reverse. So they prefer the strong, dominant. So I see this as, you know, such a challenge to the argument that they had been making about about self-domestication and bonobos. But the fact that they can make this experiment so portable means that maybe we could do some similar things to what the Yale Baby Lab did in the Yale Baby Lab, actually in places where people are trying to figure out how to deal with being unsheltered. And so maybe we can start to get some data in how humans respond in this period when I think their social sensitivities are going to be so extreme. Do they really prefer the strong dominant, or do they prefer the nice and helpful? And the student, whose name is Megan Melano, she has a strong hypothesis that under those circumstances, when everything is very dangerous and you are very unsure about anything, you definitely want some strong, dominant ally. And
oh, I see. So she's going to say it's context dependent.
Isn't that interesting? And the results that we get from a lot of the developmental psych is, you know, mostly these are children of faculty members, right? Surrounding universities. And so really a place there are, I am, you know, spend a lot of time trying to characterize what I think has been the social context for most of human experience, which is very different from what we trying to find ways to talk about that to people so they can see how those things differ from what we experience now. But in some ways, the contrast within our own society may be even greater than comparisons between you and me and folks in traditional societies. There are parts of what people cope with in our society that are unlike, in a very different way, unlike most of human experience. And how they do that may broaden our notion of what we think of, quote, human nature. Again, this comes back to Herdy's insights about that combined with Finlay. So they have to go together. That Finlay's, so I've written about building on Herdy before I crossed paths with Finlay and learned the stuff I now know about brains. And I would talk about it a little differently now, because I think the evidence from people who look at what's actually happening with brains is that the way that they wire is so experience dependent. And so it's Sarah Herdy's insights about the cognitive ecology for human infants, but that plasticity thing and the early wiring and so on comes out of Finlay's demonstration, and it makes our early weaning just so strikingly different from certainly other apes, from other primates. Mm-hmm. And that could be the heart of why we're why we're doing this. And I want you to, Christopher, do you see what I'm talking about? Yeah.
You've given me a ton to dig into, and I'm really excited to follow up on some of these names that you've been mentioning. I have a feeling that my cognitive dissonance will just grow the more I learn. You know, there's these huge discrepancies that I see between what you're describing and characterizing and what I see in society today. It just couldn't be more different in every aspect of our life. But it's fascinating nonetheless.
Well, thank you. Thank you for, and keep giving me hints. I mean, about things I need to pay attention to and places where it doesn't. Wait a minute. What about that? I mean, wait a minute. That doesn't seem consistent with these things. So please do that.
Absolutely.
That's the role you have cut out for yourself to do that.
Oh, I like that. Thank you. Where's the best place for people to come and find out more about your work and perhaps even support your work? I know that funding can be challenging at times, and perhaps you have some ideas about
funding
that.
Funding is so challenging. Yes, and it gets worse all the time. And I think everybody's going to be in a funding disaster for the next little while, you know, everybody, whatever they do.
Of course.
But so I'm on the faculty at the University of Utah in anthropology. And if there are any of my, I'm not a writer of books. Books I recommend are Sarah Hurdy's, but I have written lots of papers, continue to do that. I'd be happy if you don't have access to them, just send me an email and I'd be eager to send you a paper. And then you can tell me what you think and where you think I'm missing the boat. Because having an audience to talk back is part of, a thing that maybe by continually doing that, we get closer to being closer to getting it sort of correct. Maybe.
Maybe. What about helping to support your lab?
That would be great. So there I am. I am on the faculty at the University of Utah and Department of Anthropology.
Okay.
So if you want to send support, we'd be so pleased.
Excellent. Well, Kristen, you've been very generous with your time. This has been
thank
fantastic.
You,
I'm super excited about your work. So thank you so much
for
everything you do.
Thank you.